Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Hey, I finally finished reading Donna Tartt's novel, The Goldfinch, recently. It took forever, because first, it's really long, and second, I kept having to put it down to read other books we were talking about on the show. Now, there's actually a surprising amount of music referenced in her novel, but of course, not nearly as much as you would find in, say, the memoir by former Smiths frontman Morrissey, or in the new biography of Alex Chilton, the teen pop star who later became the prototype and role model for a much later generation of indie rockers. We will be talking about both of those on the show today. I liked Holly George Warren's new book about Alex Chilton, and she's here to tell us his long and winding story. The Morrissey book? Yeah, I didn't read it. Sorry, the ratio of thriller to filler was just too small for me. But as some of you know, our producer Joel Meyer plowed through the whole thing, and he'll wrap up Soundcheck's Morrissey Book Club later on the show. To begin, we have a live performance. With their classic Americana rock sound, Houndmouth is the pride of New Albany, Indiana, a town right across the river from Louisville, Kentucky. But they're here in our New York studio, so we'll talk with them in a bit and hear some more songs. Right now, they're going to kick things off with a tune called Halfway to Hardensburg. It's Houndmouth, live on Soundcheck.
To speak, so you grab a pen and you head out for the table. You scotch tape a note down of words that you wrote down, resembling an old English fable. And you were halfway. Thank you.
That's Houndmouth live on Soundcheck and a song called Halfway to Hardensburg. They're going to play some more songs for us and we'll get a chance to talk with them a little bit as well. Houndmouth performing for us on Soundcheck today. He may not be a household name, but the late Alex Chilton sure does get a lot of attention, starting with this song called Alex Chilton by the Minnesota alternative band The Replacements. He's also been name-checked by REM and Wilco. There's a recent documentary film about his band from the 70s called Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. Alex Chilton's status as an underground music icon is reaffirmed again in Holly George Warren's new book, A Man Called Destruction, the life and music of Alex Chilton, from box tops to big star to backdoor man. Holly joins me once again in the Soundcheck studio. Good to see you.
Great to be back, John.
So the book is called A Man Called Destruction. Was there a kind of self-destructive streak to this very gifted musician?
Well, actually, the title comes from an album that Alex did in 1995, A Man Called Destruction. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think more in terms, especially as I did all the research on the book and just listening to Alex's music again, that it's kind of more in line of, to paraphrase Picasso, to create, you first must destroy. And I think it's really, Alex had a very restless artistic spirit. He didn't want to stick with one kind of music. He was a voracious lover of all genres of music, both in the music that he sang and wrote himself, but also what he liked to listen to and then cover. So it's really more that he didn't want to be categorized or, you know, he didn't want to be the big star guy. He didn't want to be the box tops lead singer guy. He really liked being this eclectic, kind of unpredictable artist.
Well, he did start. I mean, this is like, you know, as opposed to rags to riches, his story is the reverse. He starts right out of the gate with a huge number one hit song and then seems to spend the rest of his career kind of disassembling the mechanism that made him a star in the first place.
Yeah, timing was kind of everything. You know, he was just barely 16 when he sang The Letter in this very great Memphis studio, American Recording Studio, produced by the wonderful Dan Penn. And the Box Tops, I mean, the group itself didn't even have that name, the Box Tops, yet. They were this kind of garage band called the DeVilles. Alex was completely unprepared for being thrown out into the world of stardom. He dropped out of school in 10th grade to go on the road and basically spent the next almost 3 years constantly touring and, you know, scoring a few other hits. Mm-hmm. But this was a time when, you know, heavy music and, you know, album, you know, radio stations were starting to happen, and they were considered a pop band, even though with his raspy, bluesy vocal style in the Box Tops primarily, a lot of people thought, you know, he was like a 40-year-old black man, you know, instead of this 16-year-old white kid from Memphis.
Let's hear the song that made 16-year-old Alex Chilton an international celebrity, the song from the Box Tops called The Letter.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't live without me. Got to get back to my baby once more. Anyway, yeah, got a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
1967, the Box Tops number one hit, The Letter, featuring Alex Chilton, 16 years old at the time, out of Memphis. He is the subject of Holly George Warren's latest book called A Man Called Destruction, the life and music of Alex Chilton from Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. Yeah, you mentioned a moment ago, Holly, that kind of gravelly, much older sounding voice, which is not the voice he would then use once he became Alex Chilton or, you know, led any of his various other bands. So we're talking about a guy who bursts on the scene, you know, international success, and then proceeds to follow it up with a couple of, you know, other singles that do well, and then goes through this kind of steady process for the rest of his career of kind of reinventing himself, each time a little bit further removed from popularity and celebrity and stuff. Did you get the impression that this was a conscious choice on his part? Was it few? I mean, I lost track of how many times he talks about taking pills and being totally drunk and stuff.
Well, Alex really had to follow his muse. He had to do the kind of music that spoke to him, that he felt like doing at the time. It didn't matter if it was out of vogue with what was cool, you know? And what's interesting about Alex's musical choices is a lot of the music that he ended up being engaged in was really ahead of its time. I mean, people made fun of him doing Volare and stuff. Hey, a few years later, there was this lounge music craze. You know, Americana music, which is huge now. I'll tell you something. When I heard his much maligned, which I loved, Like Flies on Sherbert, which came out in the late 70s, he was doing Carter Family, Cajun, R&B, blues, you know, really vernacular American music, kind of deconstructed.
And if he had done that 20 years later,
it would be huge.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing with lo-fi, you know, he was recording these lo-fi records that, of course, later Pavement and all these indie rock bands were embracing that style. So part of it was that I think Alex just followed his own vision and did the kind of music he wanted to do. And of course, when Big Star got back together in the 90s, he could have easily cashed in and recorded a Big Star-ish kind of album for a major label, but he refused to do that.
Yeah. All right. Now, since you've mentioned Big Star, and since Big Star is the band upon which Alex Chilton's legend rests, let's talk about that group. Here we go from the gravelly lower voice singer of the Box Tops to this kind of higher tenor in the band Big Star. And as you're saying, you know, he's often ahead of the curve. The funny thing with Big Star is they were right at the peak of the curve. If you listen to the sound with those Beatles-esque harmonies, and we're talking early 70s, this should have been a massively successful band.
Well, unfortunately, there was another big trend in the early 70s, and I grew up in North Carolina, not too far from Memphis, and kind of the heavy, you know, blues rock, Humble Pie, and of course Led Zeppelin,
Mountain,
Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
You know, that was huge. And then, of course, the whole prog rock thing. Yes, Emerson, Lake & Palmer. So, you know, people were trying to, you know, FM, you know, radio that was starting to happen in the larger, you know, markets was kind of embracing that kind of style, whereas AM was still playing the more poppy kind of stuff. So with Big Star, they really didn't fit into any kind of category. And then, of course, they had horrible luck with record label distribution and all these kind of things that were going on, you know, behind the scenes that affected the distribution of those records.
So when Alex Chilton and Company released their first album as Big Star in 1972, it's called Number One Record. A title that would turn out to be quite ironic for a record that, as you say, had real problems just getting into the stores. People liked it. They just couldn't buy it.
Exactly.
They couldn't find it.
I mean, critics raved about it. It got, you know, wonderful reviews and everything from Rolling Stone to Billboard. But, you know, sure enough, people couldn't find the records.
The song In the Street comes from that record by the band Big Star.
We'll be right back.
Big Star, featuring Alex Chilton, and a song called In the Street from their 1972 debut, Number One Record. For a guy who knew all about Number One Records from his time with the Box Tops, how did he respond to the challenge, Holly, of being, you know, in a band that was not, that was getting the critical acclaim but wasn't getting the popular response?
Well, in the beginning, Alex, I don't think, was that upset about it because he was already used to the ups and downs of the record business. He kind of knew what it was all about. His partner in songwriting and lead vocals, however, Chris Bell, was just completely devastated by the lack of success. He just knew it was going to be a huge smash and all this kind of thing. And that disappointment really took its toll on Chris Bell's outlook on life mm-hmm. and mental state. And he eventually left the band not too long after the record came out. He was also getting a little resentful about the fact that they were getting media coverage in the press and they were all centering around Alex and calling it Alex's band and all this kind of thing. And that's because, you know, as some journalists happen to do, they, you know, try to peg things on a known name. And since right. Alex was known from, you know, back in the Box Tops days and had actually gotten, even in the New Yorker, Ellen Willis had written about this great young singer of the Box Tops. So he'd gotten critical respect even when they were in that teeny bopper so-called world. So Chris just couldn't take it anymore and quit the band.
And it really was Chris's band before Alex came along, but then Chris leaves and it does in fact become Alex Chilton's
That's
band.
That's correct. Yeah, it becomes a three-piece with Jody Stevens on drums and Andy Hummel on bass, the original components of the
and
band.
And they release another album called Radio City, which includes this Big Star classic called September Girls. It is a 1974 album by Big Star, led by singer and songwriter Alex Chilton. The album called Radio City. The song is called September Girls. My guest is Holly George Warren, who's done a lot of music writing over the years. Her latest book is out now, just out now. It's called A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, From Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. And, you know, you listen to that song and those jangly guitars, and 30 years later, that would be the sound of Brooklyn indie rock. And here's this guy doing it in Memphis in the early 1970s.
I know. It was, I mean, it's the perfect pop song. It's just like a crime that that song was not a hit in its day. But funnily enough, Alex said something to the effect that, well, you know, maybe if Big Star had been a big hit then, you know, and we scored with September Girls, it wouldn't be so revered today. People wouldn't care so much about the band today. And it was like this little secret treasure that when people discovered it, they would tell their friends and literally go down through the generations. I mean, I have a 16-year-old son who loves Big Star, loves 13 from the first album, loves September Girls, and shares that with his friends. So it continues.
Let's go back to Big Star, which releases the third album. And, you know, again, there's no distribution and Alex gives it up as a bad job.
They couldn't even get a record label to put it out.
So he comes to New York City and it's the mid-70s and punk is in full flower. And here's Alex Chilton, ex-pop star from the Box Tops, this kind of early proto-alt rocker from Big Star. And now he's here in New York working with bands like the Cramps. Yet another reinvention.
Yeah, he loved the punk scene and was pretty much a regular at CBGB's. Kind of, that was back when they even had a little kitchen. He even ate there. And Max's and really was part of that scene. He discovered the Cramps and went nuts over them. and said, I want to produce y'all, you know, I'll come down to Memphis with me. I can get you free studio time. I mean, he was this enthusiastic music lover. When he found something that he liked it all the way. Some of those stories behind the working together with the Cramps was my favorite part of researching the book, because there are just so many funny misadventures with those guys.
And, you know, for someone who, as you said before, was very early on a fan of Americana, hearing the rockabilly sound of bands like the Cramps, you know, he would have seen past the veneer of, oh, this is brand new, this punk thing, to see the musical roots that were there.
Yeah, he loved that primal, you know, psychobilly, as a lot of people call the Cramps, right, music that they were doing, where it's all about the emotion and the rhythm. And, you know, Lux Interior was this amazing front man that I think really was inspirational to Alex, too.
And if you listen to some of Alex's own music from that time, there's this one-off single called Bangkok.
Yeah, that single.
From 1977. This is Alex Chilton in New York.
It's a little thing that's gonna please ya. Just a little town down in Indonesia, Bangkok. Men lying in bed. One got his mouser, the other said Bangkok. Oh, Bangkok. Making love the Japanese way. I learned aggressively in Hong Kong, Bangkok. Margaret Trudeau, Jackie O.
That is such a politically incorrect song.
I know.
There's so much wrong with that song. First of all, Bangkok is not in Indonesia. It's in Thailand. But that's Alex Chilton, not caring.
Yes.
Holly George Warren is with us on Soundcheck. Her brand new book is called A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, From Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. And Holly mentioned meeting him on the streets in New Orleans in 1982. He would eventually produce your band a couple of years later. He goes to New Orleans to basically, what, clean up, get his act together, work with his hands?
Unbelievably, in the land of drive-through, you know, cocktail lounges and things like that, he went to New Orleans to quit drinking, which he successfully did, just to show the guy, when he set his mind to something, he could do it.
Yeah. And then in the 80s, his name begins to spread. We heard earlier the Replacements, you know, doing their song called Alex Chilton. So he begins to figure into the mythology, the creation myth of a lot of the first kind of alternate or underground rock bands of the late 80s, early 90s. As the 90s go on, how did he feel about the possibility of, you know, Alex Chilton as a rock star, you know, people coming to see, wanting to see big star reunions, et cetera?
Alex was not a big fan of fame. He didn't like the trappings. He hated, you know, adulation and that kind of thing. He wanted respect, of course, and he wanted to make a decent living as a musician, and that's kind of where the backdoor man part of the story comes in. He was very happy to be able to make a good living for a change, literally touring the country with a trio and playing the songs that he wanted to play. He'd throw in once in a while a big star song, a box top song. He would do that in the early days, in the 80s and the 90s, when he was out touring. And as artists started covering his songs, he enjoyed cashing those checks. So he really had finally a successful, you know, musician life happening in the late 80s. But he had kind of at that point realized that, you know, trying to go for another hit was pretty much, you know, not going to happen if he wanted to play the kind of music that he wanted to do. I mean, yes, people would have probably given him a big advance to go into the studio and do big star type songs, but he wasn't interested in doing that kind of music
for a whole album. And he was always, as you write numerous times in the book, he was always doing covers of other people's songs. And that would always, that seemed to be like part and parcel of who Alex Chilton was.
Yeah, it was imprinted on him, you know, as a kid in the Moondogs, when he was, you know, his first ever garage band, even before the DeVilles, which became the Box Tops. You know, doing cover songs was always the thing to do. And that's how he learned to play music. He learned all these songs that his dad had in his big record collection, you know, Chet Baker songs, Ray Charles songs. He'd always been this sponge soaking up music, and he had this incredible memory for music. Mm-hmm. He remembered songs that, you know, he would just pull them out of a hat. It was incredible.
Day to run, day run, day to run. I got it bad for the new girl in school. The guys are flipping, but I'm playing it cool. Everybody's passing notes in class. They really dig her now, she's such a gas. I got it bad for the new girl in school. The chicks are jealous of the new girl in school. They put her down and they treat her so cruel. But the guys are going out of their minds, 'cause she's the finest chick you'll ever find.
But he did eventually reform a kind of version of Big Star. And for a guy who was so uncomfortable with fame, and I don't want to be glib here, but his final act, you know, passing away while the band is waiting for him on the huge national stage of South by Southwest, the South by Southwest Fest. It was like one final way in which Alex Chilton cheats fame.
Exactly. And I mean, it wasn't the first time the new big star had played at South by Southwest. And Alex, I had seen all of those shows at South by. And in fact, I was there and heard the devastating news of his passing. And my first thought was like, oh, maybe it's a hoax. You know, maybe Alex is just trying to get out of coming to South by. He decided he was going to blow it off. And he's, you know, putting this fake news item out there. But it came to be, you know, horribly true. But it is interesting because that South by Southwest of 2010, it really was like a 4-day wake for Alex. Yep. I mean, everybody from, you know, Ray Davies to Courtney Love to John Hyatt. I mean, I was going to shows still, even though I was so brokenhearted. Everybody was doing a shout out to Alex, Cheap Trick. I mean, almost every major artist there was remembering Alex. So if the kids at South by that year didn't know who he was, they certainly did by the end of it.
Right. Because everybody was playing his songs. I mean, you mentioned Cheap Trick, who had, of course, a huge hit with a cover of one of Alex's tunes. So he dies in 2010. The book is out now. What is the prospect for yet another kind of revival of interest in Big Star and maybe even the later Alex Chilton material?
Well, I really hope my book brings to people's attention all the diversity of his music because, you know, there's like the Big Star camp, and there's the Box Tops camp, and then there's the Alex Solo Years camp, and the, you know, kind of Tav Falco, Panther Burns Alex camp,
right,
you know,
right, right.
Which we didn't have a chance to talk about. But, you know, a lot of people only know about a certain fragment of his music, and the guy was just, you know, he was this multifaceted artist. And I think it would be really cool for people to learn about all these different styles that he did and find a lot of beauty in his work in all kinds of directions.
Holly George Warren is the author of A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, From Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. Holly's doing an event this Monday at McNally Jackson here in New York at 7 p.m. And then next Friday, the 28th, at Hi-Fi with some live music
of
Alex
Chilton.
Yes, we'll
be remembering Alex through his music.
Also at 7 p.m. Holly, it's always a pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you so much for playing these great tunes, and I just can't ever get enough of Alex Chilton's music.
Well, here's a little more from the 1995 album called A Man Called Destruction.
Capricorn, Sagittarius, Aquarius, Pisces, Gemini, Aries, Scorpio, Libra, Virgo, Taurus, Cancer, Leo. What's your sign, girl?
Up next, more from our musical guests, the band Houndmouth, and later, the dramatic conclusion of our 3-week project, the Morrissey Book Club. This is Soundcheck.
I'm going down.
Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Louisville, Kentucky is known by many as the gateway to the South, so it's not surprising that rootsy, folky musical acts like Bonnie Prince Billy and My Morning Jacket got their start there. Somewhat lesser known is New Albany, Indiana, just across the Ohio River from Louisville. That's where the band Houndmouth formed, and their debut album, From the Hills Below the City, trades in a similar marriage of pop and rootsy Americana. The band joins me in the studio to play some songs from that 2013 release. Here is Houndmouth with Penitentiary, live on Soundcheck. That is the band Houndmouth, live on Soundcheck with their song Penitentiary, which you'll find on their album From the Hills Below the City, which is out now. Let me introduce you to the members of Houndmouth: Matt Myers on guitar, Katie Tupin on keyboard, Zach Appleby on bass, Shane Cody on drums, everybody singing. And Matt and Zach joining me at the microphone. Guys, welcome.
How's it going?
You guys looked like you were having a good time at the end of that there. It's nice to see. You know, you're in the middle of a tour. Yeah. You might be getting sick of the same songs, but...
Well, we do get sick of the same songs, but we sit in a van, so it's better to play the same songs and just maintain and sitting in the van.
But the fact that you can still kind of be grinning at each other as a song is ending, like, wow, we got through that again.
Yeah, we made it.
Well, every now and again, we like to do something a little different to try to throw each other off and see if we can mess each other up.
Yeah. I kind of suspected maybe that was what was going on there. Yeah. So you ended up, Zach, singing the last bit.
Right.
While Katie and Matt, you guys were doing the woo-woo-woos.
Yeah.
And actually, is that how it's supposed to go, or was that like a
little...
No, it's, okay.
Yeah.
Shane and I do the last, and Shane's in there as well.
All right. Now, listening to these songs... You know, there's a fair amount of kind of Southern Gothic stuff. There's people in jail, people who probably should be in jail but aren't, and stuff like that. What's the attraction of that kind of, you know, writing to the dark side like that?
I've always liked, even visual art, like just dark stuff, you know? I don't know what the allure is. Maybe I'm just kind of a sad person. I don't hold myself in, like, sad regards, I don't think, but I love... singing about just down stuff and like melancholy. It almost puts me in a better mood when I listen to melancholy music.
Right. Well, I'm assuming that unlike the narrator of that last song, you didn't have trouble finding a job and therefore learn to rob.
Right.
But, you know.
Oh, yeah, that one. That was a tribute to Jimmy Rogers, Waiting on a Train.
Okay.
I just like that song a lot.
Now, you guys write a lot about specific places, you know, towns and mostly from the area around the Midwest and the South. Is there a kind of specific kind of local flavor that you guys hear in these songs?
I don't know if it's a local flavor. We write what we know pretty much and what we've seen, I guess, after the last comment about Matt not robbing. I guess that was a bit of a lie, what I just told
him. Well, you know.
To a certain extent.
Well,
we
you have to have a setting for your stories, and you have to know something about, at least know a little bit about what you're writing about.
Mm-hmm. So you know Ludlow, and you know Hardensburg.
Hardensburg, Indiana, yeah.
Okay. Now, New Albany, that's across the river from Louisville. How active is the scene in Louisville now?
The music scene?
You can pretty much find whatever you're looking for. I heard a good analogy. Nashville is like the Paul McCartney and Louisville is like the Lennon. If you're comparing the two, it's just, it gets, you know, it can get weird and it's fantastic. And you can just find whatever you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to the members of the band Houndmouth from New Albany, Indiana, just across the river from Louisville. Where does that name Houndmouth come from?
You can take this
one. Oh, yes. We were recording and we recorded at night in Shane's parents' place, and it was we had a hard time because of the traffic. We lived next to a firehouse, and the only thing keeping us from recording were the two dogs. We had to do it at night to get away from the traffic, but the dogs were still there barking. And Shane was recording us. He was recording the EP, and we do all these tracks, and he had his headphones on and just be sitting there. It was late. We were drinking, and he's kind of slurring like, oh, no, there's too much hound mouth on these tracks. And we just kept it.
So on the EP, you can actually hear Shane's dogs, or
They weren't his dogs; they were the neighbors.
The neighbors' dogs.
Yeah, Charles and Barkley were the two dogs.
Charles and Barkley.
Yeah.
All right. Very nice. The idea of guitar, this kind of, I know it's a keyboard, but it has that kind of classic Hammond B3 sound. You know, the guitar, the keyboard, the bass, the drums. It is a classic band sound, which you can say with a small B or with a capital B as well. I mean, you guys have been pretty open about, you know, the influence of the band.
Oh, we love the band, yeah.
Which is a little before your time. Is this like your parents' music? How did you get
into
that?
Yeah, I grew up listening to Randy Newman and like James Brown. A lot of stuff recorded in the like early 70s, late 60s, and I guess that's where when I heard the band, it was just like, oh, that's just like what I was listening to growing up. It just had that sound.
What, you mean when you heard this band?
No. When I heard the band.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so was the sound of Houndmouth kind of modeled on that, or did it just kind of work out?
We didn't go into it knowing that we wanted to sound like the band. And I still don't think we do sound like the band too much, but we just had some songs written and threw them out there.
All right, now, getting back to this idea of the Southern Gothic, what is happening in Casino, which is subtitled Bad Things?
I'm not sure. Katie's sitting over there. It's her birthday, by the way.
Happy birthday, Katie.
Is that like a, is that just kind of like a figment? Like a, just a betrayal of somebody that, is that you?
I'm not supposed to answer these questions. I didn't think I was supposed to be talking right now.
Oh, that's true. You can't. You don't have to talk on your birthday.
But you do have to sing. So yeah. Why don't we get you all to singing and playing? The song is called Casino, Bad Things, and it's from the band Houndmouth, performing here in the Soundcheck studio. The album's called From the Hills Below the City, and this song is Casino. Here's Houndmouth.
They got me doing bad things. Poker chips, chains and whips. They got me wearing red lipstick. And I can't trust no man of mine to watch the door while I do my lines. Yeah, they got me doing bad things. I got my friends inside my pockets. Got my chin tucked in my purse. I keep my heart. They got me doing bad things. I got my friends inside my pockets. Got my chin tucked in my purse. I keep my heart locked in gold so I don't ever get hurt. And I gamble till the lights of the casino gone.
Song is called Casino, subtitled Bad Things. You'll find it on Houndmouth's full-length record called From the Hills Below the City. Once again, Matt Myers on guitar and vocals, Katie Tupin playing keyboard and vocals, Zach Appleby bass and vocals, Shane Cody behind the drums, and yes, more vocals. Houndmouth's album is called From the Hills Below the City. And Matt, you guys have been touring a lot in the last year. We were talking before about you write what you know. You have all these towns, these place names in the songs. Now that you've seen more of the country, is that likely to expand the palette for the next batch of songs?
Yeah, our world's expanding a little bit. Even passing road signs, you just find, these great, great names, you know?
Yeah, road signs can do that. You pass like a weird town name or something.
Right?
In England, they have places like Church Stretton. You think, wow, what could that be?
Exactly.
What must that look like? You know,
right?
And Zach. So with all the touring, you guys are spending lots of time in the van.
Right.
Who's in charge of the music in the van?
Usually whoever is driving or riding shotgun.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what is the music that keeps this band barreling down the highway?
Bob Dylan, Desire.
Bob Dylan, yeah, the Desire album's heavy right now.
Yeah, it's on heavy rotation. Yeah.
And Queen, we just got Queen's greatest hits.
Yeah.
Available on the old iPod there. So,
okay.
So that.
Well, that's a kind of a sharp left turn music.
Right.
From Bob Dylan.
It goes everywhere, though.
That's true.
When you listen to the same thing over and over and over, it's anything and everything that's new is great.
Yeah, so. Surprisingly, the band got old after a while.
Yeah.
Which I didn't think that could happen.
Right.
Well, you know, hour upon hour, day after day on the road. Yeah. All right. Well, the album is called From the Hills Below the City. Houndmouth is playing here in the Soundcheck studio. This has been a lot of fun, guys. Thanks so much for being with us. And Katie, happy birthday. Up next, an exit interview. 3 weeks ago, our producers embarked on a journey into the memoir recently published by Morrissey, the solo artist and founding member of The Smiths. Only one of our producers made it to the end of the book, and we'll find out why as we wrap up the tattered remnants of the Morrissey Book Club. Next on Soundcheck.
Why do you come here when you know it?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. For years, Morrissey had hinted that he might be writing a memoir, and when it finally arrived last fall in the UK, and then later in an American edition, the singer's rabid cult of fans devoured it. Eager for morsels about Morrissey's years with the influential rock group The Smiths, his solo career, and yes, his personal life. Critics were less kind to the book. Sasha Frere Jones of The New Yorker wrote, "Morrissey's autobiography may, ultimately, be a lesson about editing." Many critics pointed to a long rehashing of a legal fight over royalties from The Smiths. That section runs to nearly 50 pages. Undeterred, our producer and Fairweather Smiths fan Joel Meyer launched something called the Morrissey Book Club, where he asked listeners and two of our producers to read the book with him. Not everyone survived. In a podcast available on soundcheck.org, Joel and fellow producer Katie Bishop talk with Tony Fletcher, author of The Smiths' biography, A Light That Never Goes Out. They talked about Morrissey's autobiography. Here's an excerpt.
Hey, Tony.
Hi there, Joe. How are you doing?
Well, good. And I want to say on your behalf, Tony, to all the people that are listening to our voices that have finished the book, congratulations. Just congratulations, everybody, for making it through the Morrissey biography. It's great in parts, but I found it to be a little bit of a slog in the middle. Tony, people were really excited about the book. Can you explain what people were expecting from this book? What were the things that they were looking for Morrissey to deliver on?
Well, if we're going to be brutally honest about it, and I sort of wish this wasn't the case, but it's the celebrity culture that we live in. I think people wanted Morrissey to come clean about his sexuality. I think they wanted him to kind of kiss and tell. I think that there has been so much deliberate confusion about Morrissey's lifestyle. I mean, from his own part, whether he's celibate, whether he's homosexual, whether he's bisexual, whether he, and for all that he has always said, maybe apart from the early kind of celibate claims, look, it's nobody's business, and I want to project something else. I think people sort of thought, well, when Morrissey writes his book, he's going to come clean on all of that, and we'll know more about him. But I also think the fact that Morrissey, we cannot overemphasize the impact of his lyrics when the Smiths came on the scene. Nobody had ever written quite like Morrissey, and probably in a way nobody will again, because you can only break those barriers once.
You mentioned the curiosity about his sexuality, the sort of deliberate misinformation that he might be putting out there at different times about his personal life. In the UK, British readers got one version of that story that had juicy tidbits, or about as juicy as they come, basically, when it comes to Morrissey. Here in the US, we got more of a redacted version when it comes to the photographer Jake Owens. How important do you think that omission was in the American version?
I think it's extraordinarily important, and I wish we could really understand the reason why, because actually it's the British who have stronger libel laws. So I'm really surprised it was that way around. I almost thought it might have been the other way around. And it seems to me a great shame, because to the extent that he said anything about himself, and he didn't literally say Jake and I were lovers, he intimated that he and Jake were lovers. Let me put it that way. That is the takeaway that I got from reading that section. I think that to then leave that out of the American edition is somewhat disappointing, because it's not exactly a great shock to anybody, and B, it's not exactly shocking in this day and age. And so it genuinely surprised me. I'm hoping somewhere down the line we can find out whether that was the publishers ran a little bit scared, or maybe, you know, it's always possible that after the British edition came out, Morrissey had second thoughts about including that content, because there was a gap of a couple of months between the British edition and the American edition.
I'm speaking with Tony Fletcher. He's author of the biography A Light That Never Goes Out, The Enduring Saga of the Smiths. His most recent book is the memoir Boy About Town. He's a frequent guest here on Soundcheck, and the Morrissey Book Club has called upon him to be our post-game analysis guest to talk about Autobiography by Morrissey. Tony, I did some writing on the Soundcheck site about the things that I loved about the site. One thing that I really latched onto was how good he is at writing about pop culture. You know, he spends several pages talking about all of his favorite television shows, nearly two dozen children's shows from his youth, that he really goes on this really almost sort of heartwarming rant about these TV shows. When he writes about music, when he writes about how much he loves the New York Dolls, both as a when he was a kid and how much he loves them now, there's this, you know, behind that massive ego that is Morrissey, there's this great fanboy. I want to read you a couple of things that the people that were members of the Morrissey Book Club sent to us. Susan from the Bronx had just read your biography about the Smiths, and she wrote, "I'm ready for Morrissey's take, which will certainly prove insufferable. That's his charm, his contrariness." And according to G, tweeted us this, "Love the book. The part about the court case made me feel like I was on trial instead of him." And then a second tweet came in that said, "But you have to admit, for all its flaws, it's one of the most poetic books ever written." He needs a hug, though.
"And in the absence of human touch, I have decided I'm throwing my arms around."
One of the other things I wrote about on the Soundcheck site was that we lost some soldiers in the Morrissey Book Club. Three of our staffers started out reading the Morrissey book. Only one staff member finished it. So joining me here in the studio is our associate producer, Katie Bishop. Welcome, Katie.
Hello. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Katie.
Katie, what do you have to say for yourself?
First of all, I'd like to say I was voted my class overachiever in high school, so this is not typical of my behavior. However, I only made it to about page 70 in the book.
And that I want to add here, that is before the Smiths trial, which is for many people has been the toxic part of the book, the killer.
Yes.
So
yes.
You quit early on in the book.
I quit
Why? Very
early. You know, the things that you were just talking about really enjoying, especially the long sort of list rants about various parts of his childhood, that to me was really, really difficult to get through. You know, if I want to read a list, I'll probably go to BuzzFeed. It just felt like sort of a run-on sentence a lot of the time for me. And as someone who often reads on the subway, I found myself sort of going back to the beginning of a sentence over and over again. It just was a real slog for me. And actually, the part that I stopped at is right when he was talking about the New York Dolls, which is actually a very interesting part of the book. And I sort of kick myself for not continuing to read through that part, because that was actually, I was starting to like it, but I sort of let it go.
How much did you know about Morrissey to begin with?
I came to this as a total Morrissey newbie and a total Smiths newbie also. I really don't know much about the band, and I was hoping that this would be sort of my entryway into listening to the band, knowing more about Morrissey. Unfortunately, I did not achieve my goal.
So, Tony, that's what I wanted to ask you about is, you know, I think that this book is – you have to be a Morrissey fan to really – stick with this book and really get past even the first kind of like 10 or 15 pages. I think I discovered through reading this book that I'm a much bigger Morrissey fan than I ever thought before. Is this something that you need to have a base of knowledge as a Morrissey fan in order to survive?
I think that if you come to this not knowing too much about the Smiths or Morrissey, probably your first reaction is, how on earth did this come out as a Penguin classic? The parts of the book, I think, are well written. I think parts of the book are not well written. And you really need to be coming to it as a massive Morrissey fan. Also, it should be said, Katie, it sounded like you had much more interesting material at hand.
I did.
By your bedside, perhaps.
That's true. You can go to soundcheck.org to read all about that.
Why do I give valuable time to people who don't care if I
never had? Katie Bishop is our associate producer here on Soundcheck. I'm also talking with Tony Fletcher, author of the biography A Light That Never Goes Out, The Enduring Saga of the Smiths. Tony, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And heaven knows I'm miserable now. I was looking job, and then I found a job, and heaven knows I'm miserable now. In my life, oh, why do I give valuable time?
Hear more of Soundcheck producer Joel Meyer's conversation with Tony Fletcher in the full Morrissey Book Club podcast on soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, pop star Jennifer Lopez recently released a new music video that has something to say about gender stereotypes in music videos. We'll hear how J-Lo is turning the tables with a track called I Love Ya Poppy. Plus, the R&B singer Khalees recently returned to the spotlight at last week's South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. We'll sample some of her performance. And that does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.